Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club and chair for today's program. We also welcome our listeners and viewers on radio, television, and the internet, and invite everyone to visit us at commonwealthclub.org. Today, we are pleased to host the Walter Hoadley Bank of America Annual Economic Forecast, named in honor of the club's late president and longtime board member, Dr. Walter Hoadley. Dr. Hoadley served as chief economist and senior vice president of the Bank of America. Today's program is sponsored by the club's Walter E. Hoadley Memorial Fund and Bank of America. Today, as we consider the state of the economy in the year ahead, we will hear from two distinguished speakers, Dr. Christina Romer, professor of economics at the University of California at Berkeley, and former chair of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, and Dr. Michael Boskin, professor of economics and senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Dr. Boskin served as chair of President George H.W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors. Let me say a little bit more about each of our guest speakers. As chair of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors from January 2009 until September 2010, Dr. Christina Romer was one of the four economics principals who met with President Obama daily to design and guide the administration's response to the Great Recession. Dr. Romer played a key role in the administration's macroeconomic policy, reform of the financial system, healthcare reform, and budget policy. An expert in economic history and macroeconomics, Dr. Romer is a leading scholar on the causes of the Great Depression and the impact of monetary and fiscal policy. In addition to her current role as the Class of 57 Garf B. Wilson Professor of Economics at the University of California, Berkeley, she is also co-director of the program in monetary economics at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Dr. Romer is a regular contributor to the New York Times Economic View column and a contributing editor for Bloomberg Television. Dr. Romer holds a PhD from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We also welcome our good friend Dr. Michael Boskin, who is Tully M. Friedman Professor of Economics at Stanford and Senior Fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, as well as an associate with the National Bureau of Economic Research. When he served as chairman of President George H.W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors from 1989 to 1993, the Independent Council for Excellence in Government rated Dr. Boskin's council as one of the five most respected agencies out of 100 in the federal government. While at the council, Dr. Boskin was credited with originating NAFTA and helping to resolve third world debt, as well as the financial crises affecting U.S. savings and loans institutions. He is also credited with placing the first effective controls on government spending. Dr. Boskin is internationally recognized for his research on world economic growth, tax and budget policy, and U.S. savings and consumption patterns. His op-eds appear regularly in the Wall Street Journal, and he writes a bi-monthly column on global economics syndicated in 145 countries. Dr. Boskin holds a PhD from the University of California at Berkeley. Today, Dr. Romer and Dr. Boskin will be in conversation with Mary Cranston, past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and senior partner and former firm chair at the law firm Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman. Please welcome Dr. Christina Romer, Dr. Michael Boskin, and Mary Cranston.
Thank you, Gloria, and let's get right to it. Let's start with the crystal ball question. The U.S. economy has been moving in a more positive, although modestly positive, direction. The World Bank, I think, is forecasting about a 2.5% growth rate next year. The World Bank has also, just this week, issued a warning about the situation in Europe, that it could get a lot worse. And I guess my fundamental question to both of you is, what do you think is going to happen? What do you think is going to happen in Europe? What will that do to the U.S. economy? And what? And if you could handle that both in terms of a muddling along scenario and a catastrophe scenario in Europe. And Dr. Boskin, I might start with you because you were on deck when Latin America went through a similar thing a number of years ago.
Well, let me just say that I agree that the base case outlook for the American economy is slow growth, too slow and painfully slow, given we're recovering from a deep recession, we still have high unemployment, things are improving slowly. They are improving, but slowly. And there's a lot of risk out there, of which the most obvious and the biggest is in Europe. Europe is 20% of our exports. We have a lot of financial interconnection with Europe from our banks and our money market mutual funds. So a catastrophe in Europe would be a big deal for the American economy and the global economy. Now, I think the base case outlook for Europe is barely muddling through with a lot of fits and starts. I think they've been staying one step ahead of the sheriff. I believe that the European Central Bank, by its liquidity procedures and its swap lines, has stepped up somewhat, and they still have big problems in their banking system. It's important for an American to understand that Europe's banks extend four times as high a share of credit in Europe as America's banks do in America. We rely much more on the credit markets than they do, and their banks are more thinly capitalized than ours, so there's a lot of risk. They have a complex governance structure. They have big sovereign debt problems. Europe is in a recession now. It's pretty substantial in the south of Europe. And it's likely not to improve radically anytime soon. That being said, the base case is they muddle through. In the catastrophe case, you could see a financial catastrophe with inability to resolve the banks burning their liabilities and inability to prevent major banks failing. You could see a complicated, chaotic exit from the euro rather than just the game of chicken in negotiating haircuts on the bonds going on now between the Greeks and the lenders. And that would be really, really chaotic. It's hard to imagine exactly that happens. For example, for Greece to exit the euro and return to the drachma, they would also have to, legally, they'd have to exit the European Union. So they have to leave the customs union. If they did that, there would be an issue of which laws were governing which contracts. Was it Greek law, European law? Derivatives would be governed by master netting agreements in New York. As soon as the Greeks announced, or even there was a serious hint that they were contemplating leaving the euro, all the deposits in Greek banks would exit for other parts of the eurozone. So it's very, very hard to see how that could be contained into something that didn't cause major problems. But again, I think the base case is muddling through. I would add two other points. One is that while we have that risk and others, there's a lot of cash sitting on the sidelines. Corporations' balance sheets still have a lot of cash, and there's a lot of cash sitting on the sidelines in the stock market. And if the recovery proved to be a little bit stronger, more durable, Europe seemed to be getting its act together, there's some potential for doing better than growth in the mid-2% range. If that's something to consider, I think it's a larger possibility that there would be a big event that would cause a bigger downside risk than upside. And I'd also say that there's some possibility of exceeding the exceedingly low policy expectations that people have for policy in Washington and in Europe.
Thank you.
I think, again, on the crystal ball question, what I think is very true is the United States economy is recovering, but I couldn't agree more with Michael Boskin that it's much too slow. I think one way to get a sense of that, so last month there was a lot of joy over the employment numbers. So we added 200,000 jobs in the month of December, and that was obviously good. It's a lot better than we had been doing. It's so much better than back in the heart of the recession where we were losing 750,000 jobs every month. But fundamentally, 200,000 jobs is just not nearly enough. Given the hole we are in, that you need that kind of job growth, it would take a good 8 years before we actually got back to the employment levels or the trend that we were on beforehand. So that, even if that kind of growth continues, I think it's completely unacceptable. And then Michael pointed out, and the World Bank has pointed out, one of the biggest risks that we face, that those numbers don't continue, is what's going on in Europe. That really is a ticking time bomb in terms of sort of the damage that it could do to their own economy and obviously to all of their trading partners and their partners in the financial system around the world. And that is why it is so incredibly in our interest that, as Michael put it, they get their act together. And I think the one thing that does give me hope is that the nightmare scenario is such a nightmare. I think everyone in Europe understands that if a number of countries default, if countries leave the euro, if that system breaks up, it will be devastating to their financial system, to their real economy, to the people in the eurozone. And I think that's why they are likely to muddle through as hard as it's going to be. I think that's why that's the most likely outcome, and that's why there's a hope that we will continue to keep growing, keep expanding, but it needs to be so much faster.
To give some brief perspective to that, we've had two other really severe recessions since World War II, in the mid-70s and early 80s. And out of those recessions, we grew at 6 or 7% for several years. And this time around, we're growing. I think last quarter was a little better, but we're growing in the twos. And that being said, the employment situation has been lagging even that modest growth. So we're at half speed at best on GDP and well under that on the labor market recovery. There are many reasons for that. Perhaps we'll explore some of those. But just in perspective, it's a lot better than the economy not growing or growing even more slowly and creating no jobs, but it is slow growth, especially for recovery from a deep recession.
Well, let me follow up with that because we are getting a number of questions about employment and jobs. What do you think needs to happen in the United States or perhaps globally in order to stimulate more job recovery? And what do you see as the structural changes that are making this different than the prior recoveries? And why don't we start with Dr. Romer this time?
All right. Well, I think the first thing, let me pick up where Michael left off, which is we are obviously growing, as I've said, much too slowly and slower than coming out of some other deep recessions. But it's very important to understand why. And I think the fundamental reason why this recovery is slower has to do with the nature of this recession. Something like the 1982 recession, kind of understand what was going on then. It was inflation had gotten high. Paul Volcker and the Federal Reserve jacked interest rates up to just astronomical levels. That crunched housing. That crunched consumer spending. And then when inflation was down, they could turn the spigot back on. And interest rates came down, and we were off to the races. And construction came back, and consumer spending came back. That's not what went on in this recession. This recession was born of a bursting of a housing bubble, and interest rates started at very low levels, and they quickly went down to zero in terms of what the Federal Reserve was doing. But what that means is we don't have the normal drivers coming out of one of those severe monetary policy-caused recessions, right? We've got a big overstock of housing. We're probably not going to have that surge of construction for a very long time. And so we are definitely facing sort of those sort of fundamental headwinds coming from where the economy, you know, how we got into this mess, as well as the risks in Europe. So if you take that as kind of the understanding that we are in a tough situation, we have inadequate demand, there's lots more I think the government can and should be doing. And I just tick them off very quickly. I'd say the Federal Reserve could be a lot more helpful. I think they were very good during the crisis. They held together what was a terrifying meltdown of our financial system. But I think maybe in the last year and a half, they have not been as aggressive as they could have been to help us get a stronger recovery. We have a terrible problem, as I mentioned, in the housing sector. And I think one of the things that we're learning is underwater homeowners, people that owe more on their mortgages than their homes are worth, are a drag on the economy. That basically people with high debt loads don't want to spend. They don't want to remodel their houses. They don't want to, they tend to be very nervous as they naturally would be. And I think one of the things we need to realize is we need a way to get rid of that negative equity. And I wouldn't support the government just paying for it, but we should be taking policies that encourage the financial sector to be renegotiating those mortgages, writing down those underwater mortgages. And then the last thing I think we need to do is a comprehensive fiscal plan. We have a terrible long-run deficit, and we had a very good bipartisan fiscal commission that came out with a plan for how to do it. That so-called grand bargain, we need to do it. And then part of what that will do, if we take the actions that get our long-run fiscal house in order, that gives us the space to do what we need to do right now to put people back to work, whether it's more infrastructure spending. I was a big proponent when I was in the administration of a tax cut for businesses that do what we actually want them to do, which is hire people. And I think those kind of fiscal actions would be very smart policies now if they're combined with a sensible long-run plan so we know that the deficit gets under control over the longer run.
Well, I would agree that the origins of the recession were heavily in the bursting of the housing bubble, produced, by the way, by the Fed keeping interest rates too low for too long and the serial social engineering of housing and a lot of bad decisions by borrowers and lenders on Wall Street and Main Street. So all that, I think, we sort of roughly agree on. I have a somewhat different view of the efficacy of the fiscal policy of the administration and of the last administration, not just the current one. I think it actually was not well designed. I think it was very poorly implemented. I think that was, sadly, Christie didn't get to design it. Maybe a little better. She proposed stuff, but it was basically socially engineered on Capitol Hill to do a lot of stuff that had very low payoff and was not really devoted to what was needed to be done at the time in early 2009 when there were massive private sector layoffs. I think the idea of a new fiscal stimulus is not a good idea. I think if you look at the CBO's estimates of the cost of the fiscal stimulus in 2009, it wound up costing between $300,000 and $1.1 million a job if you take the range of job estimates they do. Some people think that it actually hurt the economy. I wouldn't go that far, but I would say that combined with the other social engineering that President Obama pushed, and he's not the only one that was doing this, I'm just suggesting, of the big expansion of government and many other industries that would lead to a lot of taxes and spending beyond the short-term period, I think generated, number one, some depression on spending, and number two, a great uncertainty that greatly reduced the ability of the private sector to plan and manage and invest and hire. So I would have not somewhat overlapping but somewhat different perspective on Christie than what ought to be done. Number one, I think the most important thing is we need a lot more stability in our fiscal system, in our tax system, and in our monetary policy. I think the Fed took a small step by saying it's going to start putting forecasts of interest rates. I think they should spend a lot more time letting the market have some idea of their exit plan from their massive expansion of their balance sheet. It may be in the future, it may be pushed back longer than I would like it, but people right now have no idea when the government's going to get out of the housing market, get out of the mortgage-backed securities, get out of the treasury market, et cetera. So I think that's really important. I also think it's important to reduce the costs that have been added and are in the process of being added on business to hire workers. I think Christie's idea of I was for in 2008, early 2009, a large temporary payroll tax cut, not because I thought it was the best thing to do. I thought a stable fiscal program would be best of stabilizing at lower rates on a broader base and so on. But because given there was going to be a large expenditure that I thought would not really wind up being nearly as productive as it might be, there was very little infrastructure spending. It was very ineffective. It's very hard to do infrastructure spending as short-term stimulus. It's Harvard Ed Glaser, for example, has demonstrated. It didn't go to the areas with the highest unemployment or where there was the worst housing bursting bubble. So it didn't go to where it was most effective. It was very slow. It was politicized. The City of Los Angeles controller said it cost $2 million a job for the $110 million LA got. So I think, you know, I think it was just not designed well for short term. The nation has infrastructure needs. They ought to be dealt with in the multi-year legislative process. Some of them are federal and we ought to support those. So I would say that the biggest thing we can do is give a much more stable fiscal policy. I would agree with the long-term deficit reduction Christie mentioned, but I think it's much more important as well that we combine that with sizable medium-term deficit reduction, gradually phased in. The economy is still soft, not just dealing with the very long-term costs of Social Security and Medicare, as important as those are, but dealing with the big expansion of government and the big additional costs being imposed on the private sector. I think that would be a very good thing for stimulate the economy. The Simpson-Bowles Commission, to which she referred, proposed a much broader base, much lower rate, lower than current policy, let alone current law. So the top rate would come down well below 35% into the 20s. And some of the extra revenue generated from that would go to deficit reduction. I think that would help the economy. I think the evidence is that it's very important how you deal with the deficit. The studies of all the OECD countries since World War II and their attempts to consolidate their budgets have demonstrated that it's important that it be overwhelmingly on the spending side, and only the taxes should only be a minority partner in that battle. The successful ones, in the sense that they didn't cause recessions and successfully consolidated a budget, averaged about $6 of spending cuts for every dollar tax increase. So I think just the notion we have this issue and we're going to debate over how much of a tax increase and how much of spending cuts. It's important we reduce the medium-term and long-term deficit, and it be done overwhelmingly on the spending side.
Well, let me.
You
got to
let me jump in.
Sure, Dr. Roman.
I think it is so important because there is so much, I think, disinformation about the fiscal stimulus. And the main thing I want to say is the one slightly silver lining to this horrible cloud that we have been under is that it has generated tremendous research on the effects of fiscal policy. It has been what had been kind of a dead field is now the hottest thing for our brightest graduate students to be looking at. And what those studies are consistently finding is that both tax cuts and spending increases actually stimulate the economy. And when people, whether they're looking back in time, whether they're looking at cross-section evidence across states in the U.S., or the studies looking specifically at the Recovery Act, and I'll mention some being done by a brilliant graduate student at Stanford and some Berkeley graduate students or research at the San Francisco Fed, looking at the Recovery Act, what they come out with is that, in fact, it has done very much what the administration said it would do, which is to save or create some 3 million jobs, which is to raise employment relative to what it otherwise would have been by about 3 million jobs. And, you know, Michael likes to talk about the cost per job. And it's really important to realize that, you know, think about the Recovery Act. About a third of it was tax cuts. Another big chunk of it was money for unemployment insurance. That money doesn't disappear. It helps to create jobs, but when you give people a tax cut, they buy things that they like with it. And when you give an unemployed family unemployment insurance, they hold body and soul together. So it's not as though that money disappears. In fact, it has its useful purpose, and in some sense, the job creation is a side benefit. Likewise, when we spent money on infrastructure, on clean energy, that created something of value besides creating the job. So I think that is incredibly important. The other thing to say is on this issue, you know, when we go forward and have to do a fiscal consolidation because we do have an unsustainable long-run budget deficit, I think what most experts will tell you is it is such a big problem that there is no way you're going to solve it if you only do it on the spending side, or you only do it on entitlement spending, or you only do it on tax revenues. We're going to have to fire on all cylinders to actually get this thing under control. And that's something certainly that the Bowles-Simpson Commission did emphasize.
Well, let me refocus this just slightly, because you're both touching on a number of things that are coming up in the questions, but I'd like you to take it from a certain perspective, and that is we have extreme political polarization in this country politically around the question of tax cuts or spending cuts, and which adds to the complication of the problem. If you were given a magic wand where you could put in place the ideal policy for the United States, and I'd like each of you to answer this question, in taxation and entitlement reform, what would you do? And then the second part of the question is, what do you think our polarization politically is adding to this? It's obviously very dangerous for our country, but how do you think we could get that fixed? So two-part question, and Dr. Boskin, you want to start?
Yeah, I'm going to take 3 seconds, though. The CBO's range of job estimates is 700,000 to 3 million from the research. That's why it goes from almost $300,000 job to 1.1 million. I supported the extension of unemployment insurance. I think now it's so long that we should be combining it with training for both humanitarian and incentive reasons. Let me come back, though, to what ought to be done. First, on the longer term, Social Security should be easy to do. Nobody's benefits have to be cut. Nobody's taxes have to be raised. The current tax system is fine. Payroll tax, if we switch from wage indexing to price indexing of initial benefits, that would mean everybody's real benefits would go up with inflation. Nobody's real benefits would be cut relative to today. That would eliminate the entire deficit. I would combine it with a slightly higher retirement age in the distant future, and I'd also raise the benefits a bit for people at the bottom. On Medicare, I think that's a very, very difficult problem, but I think the only way forward is a version of the premium support plan proposed by Alice Rivlin and Paul Ryan, and more recently by Senator Ryan and Congressman Ryan and Senator Wyden, but where the subsidies were phased down as income went up. I think we all should agree that before we ask well-off people to pay higher taxes, we ought to reduce the subsidies that go to them. So that's the second point. We don't know whether that'll be enough. There's a lot of things driving healthcare spending. Economists argue even about how much of it's really inflation and how much of it's quality improvement. But that ought to be the place to start. On the medium term, I would just gradually phase spending down from the current 24 to 25% of GDP down to 20% or so. That's a little bit higher than it was in 2000. We've accomplished that in the 80s and 90s. We had a five percentage point reduction, and we had very good economic times. So I think that's doable if it's done gradually. And I would take the programs, and I try to make them a lot more effective and efficient. One of the biggest problems we have is we spend a lot of money, and it produces not nearly enough even for government work. We have 47 job training programs. Job training is a serious issue. How can the federal government really run 47 effective job training programs? What happened? In the stimulus bill, we added another one for green energy. 9% of the people got jobs. So we need to really, really get into the structure of the government and reform it to get a lot more out of programs that are targeted to people that really need them and made a lot more effective, and for the government, and to shut down programs and reduce and consolidate programs that are not very effective. From the IT purchasing to the fact that we have a bloated civilian labor force that's in the process, 45% of it will retire in the next 10 years. It should be doing what most private businesses are doing and let some attrition of that, maybe half of it, and improve the services to people that really need it with technology and one-stop shopping and things of that sort. So that's where I would head. And some of this would occur on the defense side, some of it on the discretionary side, and the medium and longer term, a lot of it would occur on the Social Security and Medicare side. On the tax system, we very badly need lower rates on a broader base. It's not popular for people voting, but the most important thing is to get the corporate rate down, which is the most important thing for our economic growth, according to the OECD, according to Christy and Mai's former person at our job in the 1960s, Art Oken, that the corporate reductions were the most stimulative of all the success of all the Kennedy tax cuts. So I think that's very important, but we ought to lower personal rates on a broader base, with far less loopholes, and have a modified 2 or 3 rate system where the top rates at the same rate as the corporate rate, and they're both in the 20s, not in the 30s or 40s.
Thank you, Dr. Romer.
You know, what is so striking about this is, you know, Michael and I come at these issues from very different, you know, ideological points of view. And yet, I think as experts in this area, there's a lot of agreement, right? So we both agree that the long-run fiscal situation is a disaster. We both agree that Social Security is a small part of the problem and probably could be fixed pretty easily. That the main thing driving our long-run budget deficit is rising government spending on health care. And we even agree on we've got to change the tax system, that the sensible way to reform both corporate taxes and individual taxes is, if possible, reduce the rates and broaden the base, get rid of the loopholes and all of that in the system. And let me just pick up on the corporate tax side. So, you know, it's a little easy to quote the OECD study that says we have the highest corporate tax rates. That's the stated rate. And what we all know is that there are so many loopholes and sweetheart deals that what American corporations pay in income tax is actually not high relative to other countries. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't change it, because it would be more sensible. It's basically very unfair to have some corporations paying much more tax than others because they got they had the better lobbyists, they had the better loophole put in. So I absolutely support that, and the president supports that. He's put corporate tax reform as a big issue. You know, it's hard because everybody likes lowering rates and nobody likes giving up their special sweetheart deal. And so actually getting a sensible race broadening through Congress is a really hard thing to do. The one that I wanted to mention, so Medicare is, you know, Medicare and Medaid are the government programs that are projected to grow dramatically, mainly because spending per person is rising over time. And that healthcare spending per person. Figuring out how to deal with that is incredibly important. So all of the proposals about premium support, they sound okay until you get into the guts of them. And when the Congressional Budget Office looks at those proposals, fundamentally what they are is greatly cutting the amount of support that the government gives. And so that the average person 20 or 30 years from now under those programs would not be getting nearly the benefits that they're getting now. And we as an economy and as a society have to decide, is that what we're willing to do, or do we want to have a proposal where we work harder to keep the existing system and to make it much more cost efficient and to work as hard as we can, as we did with the Affordable Care Act, to try to get efficiency improvements and improve the incentives for providers so we get good quality at lower costs. You know, that's certainly my point of view. I'd much rather stick with that system and make it work and continue our obligation to our seniors and poor and disabled Americans. But we absolutely have to focus on that, figure out a way to slow the growth rate of costs, and you know, we're going to have to raise revenues. If you just look at those numbers, if you want to keep a semblance of something like Medicare, if you want to keep the economy having its airports run and its border controls and whatever, we are going to have to pay for it. And that has to be a part, I think, of any solution.
Let me just make one technical point.
Excuse me, I have to make one little interruption there. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speakers today are noted economists Dr. Christina Romer and Dr. Michael Boskin, who are discussing national, regional, and global economic challenges for 2011. Dr. Boskin.
Now, I just want to clarify one thing. When Christy talks about cutting benefits, she's talking about things that are really somewhat slower growth in benefits. In Social Security, moving to price indexing, for example, nobody's real benefits would be cut. They just wouldn't be going up, or they'd be going up more slowly if you did it partially. And the premium support things that are being decided, it certainly would have the government outlays grow more slowly than currently projected. They're going up substantially. 80% of the projected growth of Medicare spending, for example, is due to increased real, that's inflation-adjusted benefits per beneficiary, not even, only 20% is due to the aging of the population. So let's be clear, there's, a debate about this, but if we're talking about cutting, let's be clear that we're talking about slowing the rate of growth. There's a lot of disinformation about that. I'll give you another example. The House Republican budget that was proposed and was denounced as draconian by some would have slowed spending from 7% to 6% growth. So these are big issues. Christy's exactly right that there's a big debate about the best way to do this. I'm very dubious about Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, actually controlling costs. There are some things in there that might have an opportunity we can learn something about, but we're going to add a lot of people to be covered by government plans, and most people now think a lot more than originally estimated. And where's the increase in the supply of doctors and hospital beds on short notice? So prices have to go up, or you have to have some sort of rationing. So there are some things in there that I think are sensible, but the basic fact of the matter is we as a society have made what the media and some in the political class think of as promises. We've made too many of them. We are a little lagging behind a bit, but we're on a course to be where Europe is, and that would be a disaster. So I wrote a book in 1986 entitled Too Many Promises, so this isn't news. We knew about demography. We knew about the rising costs. And we're going to have to get these under control. And I think one way to start is to have a budgeting that doesn't assume that projections, according to the mechanical formula going forward, are the baseline you start from. Because then you're always taking something away, including projected benefits. Another simple example. In the 2000 political campaign, one of the candidates, Christie's party, said he wouldn't raise the retirement age in Social Security. And when pressed by Tim Russert, said even for the 75-year projection period of Social Security. Which meant he was promising not to raise the entitlement, the retirement age 75 years later to people who weren't born yet. So let's be a little careful what we call cuts. That's all I'm saying. She's right that this would be different than what she wants and what some people think is desirable. I respect that point of view, even though I disagree with it.
Let me step in one more time. Sure. Just on the House budget plan for what it's going to do for Medicare. What the Congressional Budget Office said is for the typical senior that now is getting a very large fraction of their health care paid for by the government, they projected that it would be down to 40 or 50%. So that's the sense in which it is a fundamental change in how much people are going to be getting.
But if the growth of the spending isn't brought down by the changes in the structure.
And of course what we want to do is bring down the cost of spending. That's the whole idea. One of the main things, my main interest in life is macroeconomic policy, but one of the main things I worked on when I was at the Council of Economic Advisors was healthcare reform, because it is unquestionably one of the biggest issues that we face going forward. The other thing is, you know, let's be honest. The president has talked about doing some really hard things. Back in the summer, when he was talking about a grand bargain, trying to actually move something like the Bowles-Simpson proposal in Congress, he actually raised the idea of raising the eligibility age gradually for Medicare. That is an incredibly painful thing for a Democratic president to be talking about. But it shows that he absolutely thinks very realistically about the problems that we face going forward and how important it is to rein in healthcare spending, but trying to think of how do you do it in a compassionate way that does preserve our support for seniors.
Well, you know, you've both been in government, but I think even the dialogue between both of you who are some of the best scholars in the world on these topics shows the polarization. And I'm just wondering, from your government experience, do you have any good suggestions for how we can move this dialogue forward productively in this country and get away from some of the very polarized views that are being expressed?
Well, I agree that we've become polarized, and I have two perspectives on that, and I think they're both important. One is, you know, we're all Americans. We're not just Republicans or Democrats or independents. And while Christy and I, for example, have some disagreements, there are areas of agreement we should probably try to push. If we were in a room making decisions, we'd push forward on the things we could agree on. But I think it starts with the fundamental realization that people that you disagree with aren't necessarily evil. You shouldn't think of them evil until they somehow, and very few of them will, deserve that appellation. You know, we're kind of denouncing each other and demagoguing each other. The president, who, you're correct, did show a little bit of leg finally in the discussions with John Boehner, ignored the Simpson-Bowles, his own commission, when it came out. He did some other things. He denounced Congressman, invited Congressman Ryan to a speech and then denounced him in front of. So he's got a mixed record on this at best and has some credibility issues with Republicans at least and probably with the broader population. But as a general, so that's part one, is we have big problems. You know, everybody has principles. And we're not going to solve them by asking people to abandon their principles completely, but there's going to have to be some rounding off of the rough edges, and it would start by having a respect for the other side's point of view, which I always try to do, and I think not everybody does. The second point, though, is even more fundamental, which is not appreciated enough. America's lagged behind Europe, but we've now gotten to a state, some of it aggravated because of the depth of the recession, the need to have a humanitarian response to it, where half the population pays income taxes and half the population collects benefits in round numbers. And that's a very inherently unstable thing for coalition forming in a democracy. So we have political economy of the budget problems going forward. Now, the budgetary dynamics are much more complicated than that. I'm oversimplifying. But it's very, very hard when you have a tax system where half the income tax, where half the population has been removed, and then if you go to cut taxes, you're accused of giveaways to the rich because half the population is getting money back or paying nothing and they're not getting a tax cut. So Republicans demand that we focus on people who actually pay. Democrats are more interested in the benefits of the people going. Again, it's a generalization. I'm not trying to be, I'm trying to be a scientist, a positive description rather than a moralist about all this. So we have to figure out as a society how our institutions are going to adapt to these issues. Some of it's driven by demography, as the number of retirees is going to grow relative to the number of workers. We're going to have to figure out how we do this and not wind up sort of in the situation Europe's gotten into, which is prospects of a very bleak, not just short-term problem that they've gotten into with the euro and the banking crisis and so on, but with long-run prospects of stagnant growth for a long time for lots of these fiscal reasons.
Well, I think Michael's point about not impugning people's motives, you know, I can't tell you when I was in the government, you know, it was in some sense harder on my husband than for me, because when things would be written, it would just really make him mad. But, and the number of times that, you know, he'd start to write a letter and my chief of staff would say, "Now, David, you know you can't send that." But the thing that really got to him was when they didn't mind people arguing with me about the economics or about my views. It was when they ascribed evil motives. And that is the number one thing that can break down the political system. And I think that basically understanding that we all love this country and we all want it to succeed and we have different views on how you might get there, is an absolutely important part. On the polarization, I mean, one of the things that I find striking is certainly, say, on budget issues, is the degree to which the American people seem ahead of the politicians, right? That you can have a conversation with your neighbor or the checker at the grocery store, and they're going to tell you, yeah, we probably need to trim some benefits, we're going to need to get our government working better, and we're going to need to raise revenues. And they get it. They understand this is a big problem. They understand it's going to take sacrifice from everybody, and it somehow, it almost seems you get into Congress and you can't see those very simple truths. I've got to pick up, though, on this last point on the income tax, because it's something I certainly have read that Michael said many times, and talking about, you know, how many Americans don't pay income tax. Let's just remember, virtually all working Americans, they pay the payroll tax, they pay sales tax. There's lots of tax being paid in this country. And the income tax is the one part of our tax system that is an important part that is progressive, and certainly I believe it can be even more progressive and still be something that can work very well for the economy. But this idea that ordinary Americans at the lower half of the income distribution aren't paying their fair share neglects how many taxes they do pay in lots of ways, and that, I think, is deeply unfair.
I wasn't at all suggesting anything about fair shares, which is a deeper set of arguments. I mean, a simple statement. Most of the federal government is financed by income taxes. Payroll taxes primarily go to support Social Security, although that's breaking down some. So they're paying into their Social Security with the prospect of getting something in the end, and sales taxes go mostly to the state. So we're talking about the growth of the federal government. If you look at their self-interest, and people have lots of more complicated interests, I don't want to get into great detail about this, people have children and grandchildren, parents and grandparents, they retirees pay taxes as well as collect Medicare and Social Security. So there's a lot of different puts and takes, but basically we've loaded up. The growth of government is heavily financed by borrowing. 40 cents on the dollar now, it's an unprecedented level. I think it's been way too much. I think it's been irresponsible, although a lot of it's due to the recession. So it's either borrowing or income taxes going forward. And if we just did a simple calculation of what people would be paying if we continue the spending, and then have to pay taxes on the interest on the intervening debt, not even interest taxes on the interest on the interest, we'll wind up with tax rates of 70% and 80% on 80% at the top and 70% on many middle-income people, certainly middle-income people in the Bay Area, over the next 20 or 30 years. And that is another way of saying this is unsustainable, and that the burden would have been, I'm sure Christie would agree, even that would be too high. So you know, we can argue about whether this is dispositive over small changes in these programs, but we've got a pretty big set of changes to make on the fiscal side, and I think they need very badly to be primarily on spending.
So you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our radio program today has speakers, the noted economist Dr. Christina Romer and Dr. Michael Boskin, who are discussing national, regional, and global economic challenges for 2012. Let's turn our attention, if you would, to the state of California and our economy in California and our issues. What is your overall assessment of our prospects? And why don't we just start with that as a general question, and we'll get into some specifics. So, Dr. Boskin?
Well, California is a great place. Everyone in this room, I'm sure, loves it, wants it to succeed. Most people in this room have been successful, and most people still are. But California overall has gotten into a big ditch. While it's improving slowly, and in the Bay Area is doing much better than the rest of the state, and the technology sector is doing better than the rest of the Bay Area, the overall unemployment rate in California is still over 11%. With 12% of the country's population, California has one-third of the welfare recipients and 25% of the Medicaid spending. And if you look at, again, the structure of what the government spends on, it's been forced, because of the collapse in revenue, which I'll get to quickly in a second, to mitigate the spending, but it still spends in very ineffective ways. I'll give you another startling statistic to just give you an idea of how much scope there is for reforming the state government to get much better results with the same or even less spending. California spends more per incarcerated inmate. Leaving aside that there are the vast number of incarcerated inmates, whether three strikes makes any sense, than the after-tax take-home pay of the typical California family? How can you have a society that's run with any of these kind of basic statistics? So we need to get California moving with a much more sensible tax code. We need to have a much better set of institutions, a more stable funding source, a tax reform commission that the previous governor and the heads of the Senate and Assembly bipartisan group were appointed, came up with one that I think would have cut the volatility of the income tax in half, been much more pro-growth, so on. Governor Brown's choosing to go in a different direction for whatever reason. He's deciding to do that. He's sort of abandoned the Jerry Brown who ran for president and had some very good tax reform ideas along the lines of a flatter tax. So I think we need to do those sorts of things. That doesn't mean California is going to fall apart. It doesn't mean that you're all going to lose on your general obligation bonds. They're insured by the Constitution to be second in line after education. But we've got to improve our education system. We're failing too high a fraction of our kids in K-12 education. We've got to have a better designed and more effective university and state college system that provides education and opportunities for our kids for upward mobility. So I think we've got a lot to do. I think we have a lot of problems in California. I think we'll manage our way through them. But again, we also are back to in California, the main source of revenue in the general fund is the income tax. And half of it comes from 1% of taxpayers. We have very high tax rates on everything but property taxes. We're per capita, we're in the middle, and we're 37th in relative to personal income. So we've got to get our tax rates down on a broader base. That's pretty obvious. We have a variety of spending reforms we can make to make California more attractive. And we've got to get our regulatory environment down so people just can't stop anything from happening. We heard this morning the governor has some proposals in that regard, which I hope turn out to be effective.
So the first thing, I mean, we've talked a lot today about income taxes and income tax rates. And again, as you know, diehard economists, Michael and I both, I think, believe that tax rates absolutely do have incentive effects. But it's important to realize the estimates are actually that they're pretty small. So that we can talk, I mean, I support lowering marginal rates, expanding the tax base, because that is, I think, in general, good policy. But it's so easy to work yourself up into a fervor to think that higher marginal tax rates or lower marginal tax rates are the answer to all of our problems. And the empirical evidence is actually quite clear. There is an impact of marginal rates, and if you lower marginal rates, that can be helpful, but it's not very big. And so another way to say it is, you know, we've had some much higher tax rates in our history back in Dwight Eisenhower's era, back in the Clinton era, both times when the U.S. and the California economy were doing quite well. So I certainly would not say, oh, it's all tax rates, that's all we have to do. I think we've learned from various tries of that, that isn't what works. In terms of California, we are in a tough situation. We had problems before this recession started. We have a very, very dysfunctional budget system, and it absolutely needs to be fixed. But I think the other thing to realize is this recession has been particularly hard on California, that California was part of the places where the housing bubble was the biggest, and therefore it's the place where the bursting was some of the biggest and some of the most detrimental. And that is a big part of why California has been particularly affected. The other thing is sort of going forward, you know, so California is gradually recovering, just like the country is gradually recovering. And I think that's probably the most important lesson, and whenever I talk to state lawmakers, that's what I say. What one state can do to get jobs and to get growth is inherently pretty limited. You absolutely should set the environment right. You should make sure that all of your regulations are simple and it's not too hard to start a business, and you should have a great state university system like we have here in California, and you should build the infrastructure that businesses need. But fundamentally, you know, what matters for California is what's happening to the overall economy in the United States. And the reason the recovery is slow here is because the national recovery is slow. And that's why I always bring the focus back to macro policy. What could the Federal Reserve be doing? What could we be doing on the fiscal side? Some more jobs measures. What could we be doing as a national housing policy to get the whole economy going? Because that's the number one thing that would raise the California economy.
Yeah, I agree with that. I would say that, lest Christie be interpreted as saying that that's her interpretation of the evidence on taxes is the only view that major economists have. There's really a kind of a bimodal distribution of opinions in the economic direction. There are Nobel Prize winners, for example, who believe that all the 30 to 40% difference in per capita incomes between, say, France and the United States are due to their higher taxes. So I think that's too high, by the way, but I do agree that it's a sizable fraction. So, and also, when we talk about California alone, since there's so much more economic activity is mobile in and out of California than in and out of the country, which is also large because we're in a global economy, but even more so, we have problems where between our regulatory and tax environment and the uncertainty about the fiscal mess in Sacramento and how it will be resolved, sees many of the companies that start here, where we do a fabulous job, expand elsewhere. So I think it's a big part of the issue, but I do agree that sort of having a state of California stimulus program is kind of silly. Most of it would be spent outside the state.
Dr. Bossi,
I just want to step in here on the sort of what do economists believe, because this has kind of come up twice. Of Michael and I obviously have a difference about what the fiscal stimulus did and a difference about what the impact of marginal rates might be. And it comes back to your issue of polarization, because I think in some sense the way debate's gotten done in Washington is one, you know, congressman says, well, this expert says this and this expert says this, and you have this fight of experts. And I think, yes, you can find someone to say any crazy idea you want. And so that if you just did the my expert against your expert, what we really need is evidence-based policymaking, and not is there one, I will say, slightly wacky Nobel economist who thinks that all of the difference in growth is coming from marginal tax rates. I'd say look at the preponderance of the evidence. And there's actually a wonderful paper in the Journal of Economic Literature where the top minds in public finance have done a survey of what's the evidence on the effect of marginal tax rates. And they say there's a range of estimates, but most of them are in this place that says, yes, there's an effect, and it's pretty small. And I think that's exactly how you should be making any policy. Not, I think fiscal works, I think it doesn't. Let's look at the preponderance of the studies and what do they say and what's the evidence. And that's I think, how you get past this partisanship, is you say, let's at some level, let's look at what the evidence does. Let's get an unbiased reading of the evidence and see where it leads us.
Yeah, I think those studies, however, look mostly on some subset of the margins that taxes can affect things. And when you're talking about long-run performance and systems where taxes fund a lot of social insurance and unemployment insurance and benefits that have a lot of disincentive effects in their own because the benefits are high relative to after-tax wages, all that's kind of a piece. And I think that is really what the argument is about. So I don't take what your comment as dispositive. And I wouldn't call, I do agree, I think I said that I don't agree all with the estimate of Ed Prescott that it's all, but I do agree it's a sizable portion.
Let me get another topic out here that we have a number of questions from. Has to do with education. Obviously, the funding for education has been, from the state, has been shrinking in California. We've had deterioration over the last probably 20 years in the state of our K through 12, and then, of course, the UC system has been under severe strain in the last couple of years. If you had a magic wand, what would you do about state funding for education, given all the problems we have in California?
So, more support for the UC system. It really is one of the gems of this state. I mean, we often talk about the investments that previous generations have made in making the state what it is today or making our country what it is today. And the foresight to create a large system of state universities, state colleges, community colleges, I think is something that has served the California economy incredibly well. So in terms, the basic thing that this comes back to is we are facing terribly tough budget times. And, I'm actually with Michael on there's a lot of spending that we're going to need to trim and whatever. But the big point is you don't trim just across the board, and you've got to keep in mind that there are investments that any government needs to make, whether it's in infrastructure, whether it's in the education of our next generation, whether it's in basic scientific research. That's not something that the private sector has a lot of incentive to do, because it's very hard to get the returns from just investing in basic science. That's a role for the government. That's a legitimate, good role for the government. And it's what makes America the most innovative country in the world, because we generate all of these scientific breakthroughs that then go into places like Silicon Valley that help to actually power this economy forward. So I think that in terms of education, we should be spending better. We should certainly, you know, be thinking it should always be what works and things like that. But we definitely need to be keeping those investments there.
I would agree, by the way, with the government investment in basic science and research at a pre-competitive generic technology level, rather than, I think, the spending recently, for example, in energy went way beyond that. It would be better focused on basic research to actually try to accomplish something that could scale over the next 20 or 30 years, something to be significant, rather than to deploy a bunch of stuff that's kind of degenerated into farce and scandal. So that's number one. I certainly agree with that. I think we have to be careful about how much of that's funded by one state in a national system, because we can't appropriate the benefits to go to the other 49 states, let alone the rest of the world. So we need to have some sensible balance there. When I was a Bush senior CA chairman, we made large expansions, and similarly very difficult. Back then, you thought a budget deficit of $100 billion was big, not of $1.4 trillion. But we made, by those standards, big increases in investments in scientific research. So I agree with that. On the education side, I think that until we get more competition that is reflected in the K-12 system, we've got charter schools, many of which are doing an outstanding job, but until we get more competition for the public schools, and the way that they are administered, run, how performance isn't rewarded, we don't have it's very hard to get merit pay, and how powerful the teachers union is in Sacramento, I think it's very, very difficult to think of putting more money into K-12 education that is unlikely at the margin, in my view, to have much of an impact. But I think we need to get a lot more competition in places where there is competition. For example, in higher education, America is by far the best in the world, and we're very broad and very deep. We have the two great universities here in the Bay Area that Christy and I are proud to represent, but we have large numbers of them, and we go the next level and the level below that are very, very good relative to many other parts of the world. We run a large trade surplus. People come from all over the world here. But we compete for students. We compete for faculty. We compete for research grants, and it seems to me that that has to be the basis of reform in education.
What about budget reform in California? What do you think we could do politically? There have been a number of initiatives for overhauling our government. They don't seem to be getting anywhere. But if you could make some changes, what do you think would be the most effective thing to do in California?
Well, I think the main thing is you need to make it easier to make spending cuts and make revenue increases. That right now it's so difficult to get a budget passed and to take the measures that you need to do. You know, when I think about what Governor Brown is trying to do, he is making a lot of progress in an incredibly difficult situation. So the state had just a huge budget deficit, again, partly for structural factors. We were profligate in the good times, and we have this dysfunctional system. But also, California's revenues were just devastated by the fact that the unemployment rate went up to 12%. And so that, he inherited just a terrible situation. And I give him real credit that he has made tough cuts. He had to convince his own party to make some incredibly tough cuts. And then what he's asking for is some balance, is to say, I think we cut any more, that's going to really be impacting the things that Californians care about tremendously. Let's put it to the voters and say, can we please continue some taxes that are still there for a temporary period to make sure that we can deal with this deficit in a responsible way. And I think that is absolutely a sensible proposal. And I'm very hopeful that the Californian the voting population will understand that, because I think it is, you know, we have seen what happens when you cut state services and when you cut spending to education. And it's not, I think, what any of us want for the state of California. So it's that balancing act that I think we're going to have to do.
Dr. Boskin?
Yeah, I think that we really need a much more aggressive reformist notion of how the government, both federal and state and local, deliver services, with the emphasis on the effectiveness of the output and the results not being measured by how much is spent and how many voters we can tap to make them vote for us in the next election. I think that's short of that, I think I dismay that in our lifetime we're going to be happy with California's fiscal situation or the federal government's fiscal situation.
Let me turn again then to the global economy. A number of questions about competition from China and the emerging parts of the world and that impact on our growth prospects over the next few years. What would be your perspectives on that?
I think the biggest one, I think it's too easy for us to be afraid of China or to be afraid of the emerging markets. And I think the number one thing to say is that's an opportunity for us. That if China and Brazil and other countries of the world get more productive and have higher incomes, that doesn't have to mean that the United States does less well. In fact, it should be good for us because it means there's more markets for the kinds of things that we're good at, like higher education, like high-tech products, like computers, those kind of things. So I think the competition idea or somehow that we lose if they grow, I think is deeply wrong. The thing that's important is that we're all on a level playing field. And one of the things that has been a persistent problem is what China does with its currency. And that it's certainly true that the Chinese currency is not allowed to respond to market forces as much as it should. And that does hurt our industries in terms of exporting to China. It also hurts the Chinese people who are paying more for foreign products and could have a higher standard of living if their government weren't pursuing that policy. So there's a reason that Secretary Geithner is over there periodically saying, for heaven's sakes, guys, let's let this thing be market determined, because that is, I think, an important part of making sure that everybody's on an even playing field and that we all benefit when countries around the world grow and prosper.
Dr. Boskin?
Well, I'd start by a more fundamental point, which is that technology and globalization and its acceleration and the addition of 1.5 billion people to the global supply of labor able to produce traded goods from between the Deng Xiaoping's liberalizations in China, the more moderate Rajiv Gandhi liberalization in India, the collapse of the former Soviet Union, and so on, was bound to put somewhat downward pressure on less skilled labor in particular and moderately skilled labor in the advanced countries for a very long time. I think that's by far the biggest effect that people are feeling. Secondly, we have two big issues, in my opinion, with China. One is the short and medium-term rebalancing of the global economy, where America saves more, just saves less, and China consumes more. And I think we both have to work on that. Ours is heavily, but not exclusively, about getting our budget deficit down. Theirs has to be getting some more consumption and spending in China. They have a very high savings rate. Not well known here is a large fraction of that saving is in enterprises, some of which are and some of which are formerly state-owned enterprises. They should be dividending some of that out to their populace to be able to spend. So I think they're working on that in their new five-year plan. They're trying to figure out exactly this. On the currency, I do agree they ought to allow a gradual but ought to allow an appreciation. But I think that tends to get overstated because about 60% of China's exports to the U.S. or anywhere else are re-exports of components that have been shipped into China for assembly. So it's the effect of the exchange rate would be quite a bit less than if you thought about it, just everything being produced in China. So we have a lot to do with China and the other countries of the world. We have an important cooperative relationship, and we're fortunate that they're willing to buy all of our debt, because if not, our interest rates would be considerably higher.
Well, unfortunately, we have run out of time. We owe a great debt of thanks to both Dr. Boskin and Dr. Romer, who've had very interesting things to say today. I thank the audience for all of the helpful questions, and I want to thank our audience on radio and television as well. This program has been sponsored by the Walter E. Hoadley Memorial Fund and Bank of America. Thanks to the sponsors. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned. You guys were fabulous.
Oh, thank you.
We didn't have enough sparks, I don't think.